The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome, everyone, to this June 17, 2025 session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Okay, no worries. This morning on our calendar, we have four cases, three of them for oral argument. Our first case this morning is A24-1695, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Nicole Renee Berg Appellant. We are conducting these oral arguments via Zoom. We maintain later only a audio recording of the arguments for our public website. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. When you start them, please state your name and a party you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you could keep yourself muted when you're not talking and then unmute when you are, that would be appreciated. We'll try and do the same. And with that, counsel for appellant, we are ready for you to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Catherine Lockwood, Assistant State Public Defender, here on behalf of Appellant Nicole Renee Berg. The case before this court is an unusual case. We are here because Ms. Berg was convicted of fifth-degree drug possession without any evidence of drugs. There were no drugs found on her. There were no drugs that she claimed to be responsible for. There was no physical drug evidence whatsoever in this case. In almost every drug possession case, constructive or actual, the state's evidence includes the actual physical drug the defendant was alleged to have possessed at the time of the offense. Here, there was no such evidence. Their only evidence against appellant was her admission to her supervising agent that she had used drugs 4 days prior to her arrest, and the fact that she provided a positive drug test for methamphetamine. She never admitted to prior possession.
Ms. Lockwood, it goes a little bit beyond that in terms of the plea colloquy. Her attorney says, you agree that in order to use meth, you first must possess it. She says, yes. And then, well, she says, you mean like hold it in my hand? Yes. And then the attorney says, on or about that day, you actually received some meth and you had used it. And she says, yep. I mean, she's admitting that she had possession of it. Why does that not constitute a sufficient basis?
Your Honor, I think that's not the most accurate reading of the question and answer here. First of all, these are very leading questions, which is not preferred for the basis of a plea colloquy. But you can see that
this was her own attorney asking those questions in order to elicit the fact basis.
Yep. And the law is clear. It doesn't matter which attorney asks the leading questions. Leading questions are not preferred as the basis for a plea colloquy. Now here, defense counsel asks her generally, in order to use methamphetamine, you would actually have to possess it. Is that right? She qualifies it. She says, you mean hold it in my hand? Yes. Then he again provides her more information, tells her you would either have to have got methamphetamine from someone else. You would either smoke it, snorted it, rolled it around, inhaled it, ingested it, something, right? She says, yes, that's correct. None of that is admitting possession. And then he asks, and in fact, that day is what you had done. You'd actually received some methamphetamine and you'd used it, right? She says, yes, well, it was 4 days earlier, but yes.
Ms. Lockwood, can I stop you?
I'm
a little bit confused because your brief, I thought the issue in your brief was not whether she possessed it, but when she possessed it. And that you're saying that she didn't admit that she possessed it on the same day mentioned in the complaint. Isn't that the only issue on appeal?
Absolutely not. It's not the only issue. There's multiple issues here on appeal. Number one, there's no evidence that she possessed methamphetamine at all. There is no evidence that she exercised dominion and control over methamphetamine at any point in time.
So, and okay. I'm looking at your brief. I mean, I'm looking at the heading on page 8, which basically says, did not establish that she possessed thing at the time of the alleged offense. And but you're saying that you're also questioning or challenging the factual basis on the ground that there's no evidence of possession, period. Is that your
Correct.
argument? Okay.
Correct. And
Okay. Thank
throughout.
you. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. I'll continue to listen.
Okay. And it is clarified throughout my brief. I continue to say at the time of the offense or at any time, there is no evidence that she possessed methamphetamine. It is just one of several arguments about this that I assert it is necessary to prove she possessed it on the date of the offense. That's clearly not done. If that is not necessary, I also argued that they didn't prove that she possessed methamphetamine at any time. Now, back to whether her admission that in order to use methamphetamine, you have to hold it in your hand is an admission that she possessed methamphetamine. First of all, it's not an admission that she possessed the methamphetamine at issue in this case. It's a general admission that in order to use methamphetamine, generally you'd have to hold it in your hand. But holding something in your hand is not the definition of possession under the statute. You actually have to exercise dominion and control over that. We're not talking about a piece of drug paraphernalia with methamphetamine in it, like a meth pipe that's been passed around and someone holds it in their hand momentarily to use and passes it on. That's at most what she admitted to. She absolutely did not admit that at any point in time she ever exercised dominion or control over any amount of methamphetamine. And the methamphetamine, again, that was found in her system when she provided a drug test cannot form the basis of possession. Because as we know, the law is clear. Once a drug is ingested into the system, a person does not have the ability to exercise dominion or control over that drug within the person's system.
Doesn't her ingestion of drugs allow for an inference that she possessed it on the date that she ingested it?
That's all it allows for, Your Honor. Yes. An inference
So
that.
then she possessed it. So then isn't that a sufficient factual basis to show that she possessed it on the date that she ingested it?
Absolutely not. Under Lewis, that's not enough. Lewis requires further corroborating evidence, and there isn't any in this case. The fact that she acknowledged that she used methamphetamine, and you can infer that maybe she possessed it when she used it, is not enough under State v. Lewis.
Blackwood, this is your request to withdraw her plea. This is not an issue that went before a trier of fact, either a judge or a jury trial. So the basis of a plea, we look closely at what the defendant, the appellant in this case, admitted. So what's the biggest strength you have to set aside a plea that was tendered under a theory that it was not knowing or not intelligent or not voluntary?
None of those, Your Honor. Here it's that the plea is not accurate. A plea must be accurate, knowing, and voluntary in order to be
Right, so
valid.
the prong you're going at is strictly under the accuracy of the plea.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There is not a sufficient factual basis to prove the elements of the offense. In order to have an accurate guilty plea, the defendant must admit to sufficient facts that show their acts constituted their guilt of the offense, and the judge must be satisfied that it's a sufficient factual basis. And I know in respondent's brief, she mentioned there are different standards for cases that have gone to trial when you look at the sufficiency of the evidence versus when you review the validity of a guilty plea. I agree with that. When you look at the sufficiency of the evidence in a case, you actually look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict. Whereas with a guilty plea, you will have to review the facts here de novo and you see whether these facts actually meet the elements of the offense. Here, they do not. There is no controlled substance in this case. She stands convicted of possessing a controlled substance based solely on the fact that she had a positive drug test and admitted use to her agent. It's hard to find cases
Didn't
directly on point.
Ms. Lock, I mean, didn't she actually admit to possessing it as well by saying she was asked a question, a leading qu question by her attorney that on that date, quote, you had actually received some methamphetamine. And I think she replies, yep, it was 4 days prior to that, but on that on or about, yeah. Question again, on or about that date you had methamphetamine, she replied yes. I mean, isn't that more than just ingestion, but that she received it, she had it. Isn't that adequate?
There are a lot of definitions of to receive and to have something. She received the methamphetamine into her system. There are a lot of ways to have methamphetamine. I have methamphetamine in my system. I've received methamphetamine. Maybe someone held a meth pipe and I smoked from it, and now I have the methamphetamine in my system. It does not meet the legal definition of possession. That's why we have a legal definition. That's why the Supreme Court has defined it. It requires that somebody has a possessory interest and that they exercise exclusive dominion and control. This is a case where she admitted use. And yes, typically in order to use, you have a fleeting possession of that narcotic. But that's not the purpose of the statute. To be convicted of possession of a controlled substance, you actually have to exercise dominion and control over that controlled substance. And this is in line with the intent of the legislature. As you can see from the controlled substance statute at issue here, the legislature for what constitutes a controlled substance has excluded residual amounts of a controlled substance in things like drug paraphernalia. And that's exactly because they don't want to punish drug users for a drug possession offense when all the evidence they have is the residual amount in the tool that they used to use that drug. Well, this is akin to one of those cases, except we don't even have the tool or the residual amount as part of the factual basis here. We don't know what she used to ingest this methamphetamine or how it was ingested. All we know is her answers to very leading questions that generally, in order to use meth, you need to possess it or hold it in your hand, and that she had used meth. She had received and used meth 4 days prior. This does not meet the legal standard of possession to make her guilty of a felony possession of a controlled substance when we have no drug evidence in the record here. I'd like to draw the court's attention to the State v. Florine case. Now, again, like I said earlier, it's hard to find cases on point because there aren't any cases that have been affirmed for possession of drugs when there isn't any physical drug evidence. The one case on point is Lewis, and Lewis was not affirmed because there was no physical drug evidence. State v. Florine is a constructive possession case. In that case, drugs were found in the car. And the state was not able, or his conviction was based on constructive possession because he didn't physically possess the drugs at the time they were found in his vehicle. So the court held that based on the physical evidence found in his car, the state was required to prove that he consciously exercised dominion and control over the substance, either constructively or physically, and that he had knowledge of that substance. That's missing here. At least in Florine, there was a drug. And we could say, okay, who possessed this drug? Let's get to the bottom of it. In this case, we don't have a drug. And we also don't have any admission that she exercised dominion and control over a drug or that she constructive or physically possessed it while knowing what it was. We just have an admission surrounding the facts of use. I used a drug. I'm trying to be upfront and honest with my agent and telling him that I relapsed. And then she was charged and convicted for that of fifth degree possession of a controlled substance. I did discuss the policy reasons briefly in my brief, and I feel that those are important to touch on. This is not what the legislature intended, that people on supervision who provide a positive drug test to their agent and then are honest about it and admit they used can be convicted of a felony just based on that. That is what this case law would allow if this decision was affirmed. And again, another case to draw the court's attention to is the State v. Lewis case. And in that case, it was evidence of drugs in his system after he submitted to a blood test. Now in Lewis, they had the blood test results and they had track marks on his arm that they argued this was sufficient corroborating evidence to show that he had possessed the drugs that were in his system. And the Lewis court said that was not sufficient. The track marks and the fact that he had a positive drug test absent further corroborating probative evidence was not sufficient to prove that he exercised dominion and control over the substance in his system. We have even less here. We don't have the tool she used or marks or indications of use. We just have her admission that she used drugs. her admission to her agent, who she was trying to be honest to in order to continue to rehabilitate herself in the community and work in lines with the rules of her supervision. If there are no further questions from the panel, I will respond to anything else at rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lockwood. And counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Liz Brainerd. I am the attorney for the state. I am the attorney that did take this guilty plea. I'm familiar with the case. Today, I'd first like to turn to the Lewis case that Ms. Lockwood brings up. The Lewis case sets forth that a positive urine test is not in and of itself sufficient to sustain a guilty plea. And the facts of that case is this person, Mr. or Ms. Lewis, was brought to the hospital following an automobile injury by ambulance and was urine tested at the hospital after receiving medical care and had a small amount of controlled substance in her body. The court reviewed that extensively and came forth exactly how Ms. Lockwood describes it. It's not sufficient circumstantial evidence absent probative corroborating evidence of actual physical possession. So I think we have to look at what else do we have here besides a positive urine test? We have her admission. We have the actual positive test. And then we have not only her admission on the scene, but her admission during the plea colloquy that she agreed that she did use that controlled substance. So there's two tests set forth in Lewis.
Counsel, can I interrupt just to, as a preliminary? I'm just looking at Lewis. I think you said it was a guilty plea case. Isn't it a review of sufficiency after trial, or am I wrong about that?
You know, Your Honor, I don't know that, and I would defer to the court on that.
Well, we can certainly look. I'll just, you can go ahead with your argument. I just want to make sure I'm in the right case here. Thanks.
And it's State v. Lewis, 394 Northwest 2nd, 212. But the court set forth that it's important to note whether there's immediate accessibility to the controlled substance, one, and two, fully able to exert dominion and control. And as this court has already noted, that is exactly what was discussed at her plea colloquy. You must hold it in your hand. Yes, you must. She didn't say, no, there's other ways to ingest. She said, yep, you must actually hold it in your hand and prepare it for ingestion. And that's what she admitted that she did. I also would like to then just turn away from that to an argument I heard this morning for the first time, that there's no controlled substance case that holds that you must have some controlled substance produced for the court's consideration for the evidentiary basis. And I just want to turn this court's attention to State v. Olhausen. It's not briefed, but neither was this argument. In State v. Olhausen, it's an undercover drug case. The officer attempted to purchase controlled substances. The defendant fled with the controlled substance. It was wrapped in a bag. It was never visualized. It was never tested by the officer. Nonetheless, the undercover officer, based on training and experience, was permitted to testify that this all seemed consistent with controlled substance. And so to say that there's no other case without actual physical controlled substances admitted into evidence plainly is false. This again is a Chapter 152 case, State v. Olhausen, 681 Northwest 2D 21, Minnesota 2004. Again, and then in that same line as Lewis, I just want to turn to the Papadakis argument, and I think that's resolved on brief. Papadakis is a review of a post-trial case, and so I don't think it's appropriate here. We turn back then to the original argument here is whether or not this is a constitutionally valid plea for accuracy, and I believe that is is the issue that was presented to the court in the original brief. I do agree as well that there was some issue as to venue and as to the date, given that the date was admitted to be 4 days prior to the charging document. As to the venue or the location of the alleged offense or the admitted to offense, I will note in my brief, I did cite to Paulson, and Paulson has now been affirmed. Paulson was a court of appeals case. Paulson was affirmed by the Minnesota Supreme Court on June 11th, 2025. That is now Supreme Court precedent. I cannot find a current Supreme Court citation for it, but it did come out in the opinions on June 11th. As to the date, we know that the date, and I briefed this a little bit, but we know that the date is on or about, and that is what the defendant did admit to, was an on or about level of an offense. She said, I think it was about 4 days prior to the day that she came there. The public policy on this is an interesting argument that comes up, I think, as well today. I briefly argued before in the reply brief, but this argument is sufficient for any number of cases, right? This means to test a urine specimen, and if corroborated as required by Lewis by something else, by perhaps a small amount of a controlled substance, or perhaps an admission, or a piece of paraphernalia, is not just going to arise, not going to arise in just a probationary setting. It could arise in any number of criminal prosecution and investigative sentencing. I will note that Ms. Lockwood brought up that the legislature has decriminalized paraphernalia with residue in it, but the date of the offense in this case is May 15, 2023. And at that time, paraphernalia with residue was still a criminal conduct, and certainly it was the original charge in this case. I think that Ms. Lockwood agreed with me that there appears to be a different standard of review for a factual basis than from a review of a post-trial review. And I think the other thing that we need to note in that is that Ms. Lockwood and her client bear the burden of proof in this case, not the state. And that's somewhat of a difference that we are operating under here. The primary purpose, I think, in taking the colloquy goes back, I think, a nice analysis in Trott. It's not only to get out the facts of the case, but it's to aid in the rehabilitation of the defendant. They're taking responsibility in this case. Now, Trott was overturned by Rosendahl, and that is an argument that has been back and forth on brief. In these cases, when the factual basis is taken, the court has multiple duties going then. They must determine if there has been a sufficient factual basis laid, but they also must determine how best to rehabilitate the defendant and other sorts of considerations that a court has. Certainly, however, though, whether you are under Trott or Rosendahl, the court can infer certain things from the record. And in this case, the argument that the defendant said, well, there was just, you mean you have to hold it in your hand? Well, generally, that's what you have to do. I think the court can infer from that colloquy that that's exactly what she did. She intended to plead guilty. She set forth a factual basis with her attorney, and she admitted that that is, in fact, how you possess and handle methamphetamine with the intent to consume it. Your Honor, today we assert that a sufficient factual basis was entered to sustain this defendant's guilty plea, that is, on or before May 15th, 2023, in this case, up to 4 days before. Ms. Berg did hold in her hand controlled substance methamphetamine. That establishes an immediate accessibility, a prong of possession. She was able to consume that controlled substance, and that establishes her dominion over that controlled substance. And it establishes, by her admission on her parole agent's arrival to her place, that she knew that that was a impermissible act, an illegal act for her to possess that controlled substance, by her admission that she would, in fact, have a positive test. She acknowledged the unlawful nature of the possession of the controlled substance. Accordingly, today, if there are no questions for me, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the accurate and constitutionally valid guilty plea of Ms. Berg.
Thank you, Ms. Brainerd. And counsel for, excuse me, for appellant, Ms. Lockwood. Ms. Lockwood, could you hit your unmute, please? Thank you.
Thank you for that. A few things I'd like to clarify. Opposing counsel claims appellant bears the burden of proof here today to show that her plea is invalid. That's just inaccurate. There are two different standards, I do agree, when you're dealing with sufficiency of the evidence and when you're dealing with the validity of the plea. Sufficiency of the evidence, you look at the record of the case, painstaking analysis, with the light most favorable to the verdict and determine if it's sufficient. Here, with the validity of a guilty plea, this court sits with de novo review. This court has the ability to look at this case with fresh eyes, review the facts, and apply the law on its own and determine whether or not the factual basis of this plea is valid. And of course, my position is it absolutely is not. For a factual basis of a guilty plea to be valid, it has to establish each and every element of the offense. And that is important. And this painstaking analysis of a guilty plea is important because it prevents defendants from pleading guilty to offenses that are more serious than they would have been convicted of had they gone to trial. That is exactly this case. Had Ms. Berg gone to trial here, the state would have had no drugs to prove whatever drug they're claiming she possessed. They would have had her admission that she used drugs, and they would have had a positive drug test. It's very unlikely that based on this, a jury would find that she possessed, under the legal definition of the word, a controlled substance, meaning that she exercised dominion and control to the exclusion of others of this controlled substance. And in fact, the case law requires, pointing to State v. Florine, not only do you have to physically possess the controlled substance, you have to not abandon your possessory interest in the substance and rather continue to exercise dominion and control over that substance up to the time of arrest. Now, we didn't get into the other smaller parts of my argument here, but this goes to the time of the offense. So not only do I argue that they didn't prove possession at all in this case, but even if they did prove possession, it definitely was not at the time of the offense. She absolutely did not possess the methamphetamine on May 16th. We know that from clear case law that once it's in your system, you no longer have the ability to exercise dominion and control. We know she admitted to using 4 days earlier, which is not the offense date. So even if she did possess it when she used, that was 4 days earlier, not the date of the offense. And additionally, again, without having any drug evidence here, what she possessed, it's more important in a case like this to know when, where, and how this was possessed. Because there has to be, under Lewis, probative corroborating evidence to prove possession. It's not enough that she admitted she used. Yes.
Can I ask, because I was thinking sort of apropos of how you opened with, is that had it gone to trial, this, you know, wouldn't have been sufficient. But we don't actually know what would happen at trial, whether there would be other evidence, you know, whatever else she might have said to the probation officer or other evidence of possession. I mean, At this point, I'm not sure how that factors in if we just your argument. It almost seems to be like that's the trial record, and if that would be insufficient, then the plea has to be insufficient or inaccurate.
So thank you for that question, Your Honor. One of the main analysis points of looking at a guilty plea and whether the plea is valid is reviewing the factual basis of that plea and determining whether that factual basis would be sufficient to convict that defendant at trial. So that's part of the analysis this court undertakes when reviewing the validity of a plea and the sufficient and the, excuse me, the valid factual basis, whether the factual basis is sufficient, is whether the evidence she admitted would result in her guilt, admitted, proved her guilt in the plea, would be sufficient to prove her guilt at trial. You do that analysis to ensure that the defendant isn't pleading guilty to something more serious than she would have been convicted of had she gone to trial. And again, in
I
this
guess at the plea stage, when it's whether a judge could reasonably infer possession from what she said, as opposed to what happens at trial and the different standard, for example, for circumstantial evidence or inferences drawn, et cetera. I mean, they're just different. So couldn't the judge, I mean, I know we're circling back to what we've already talked about. If the judge could reasonably infer from her responses to these questions that she in fact possessed it. But you say that's not even, one couldn't infer that here. It's insufficient just constitutionally.
I see my time.
Inadequate, I should
May
say, or inaccurate.
I briefly respond?
Please.
So a court can infer based on a defendant's answers many things about the factual basis of their plea. We can infer intent from, the record of the plea, but this is an essential element of the offense, possession. We can't infer possession. It has to be proven. It has to be proven that she exercised dominion and control, that she actually possessed. Other inferences can be made about whether she knew the nature of the substance she possessed. That might be something appropriate where inferences could be made. But here, it's not appropriate to make an inference that this element of the crime is met because she tested positive on a drug test and admitted she used, and that usually to use, you have to hold it in your hand. That is not sufficient to prove she exercised dominion and control over a controlled substance.
Thank you. Thanks for your answer. Seeing no other questions, thank you both. I think we lost the lost Ms. Brainerd, I think. In any event, the case is submitted, and we'll have a decision out within the statutory time period. Thanks for your briefing and your arguments. We appreciate it.
Thank you.